How many local productions have you worked on then?
Oh, geez.
Is that kind of a loaded question with like how many you work?
It's not loaded, but my answer brings me back to my IMDb, which I believe in wholeheartedly. And I try to convert people to believe in IMDb that your credits matter. And some people don't care about your IMDb credits, but they matter to me. And so I have, once I say the number, it sounds like it's like this gargantuan amount, but it's not. But I do happen to have over 450 IMDb credits. Now, most of them are my own stuff. Some of them are big stuff. Some of it just depends. There's all kinds of jobs on there. It's not 400. I'm not saying I've produced 450 features. That's not what I'm saying.
You're not Roger Corman.
And I'm not Roger Corman yet. I'm not Robert Rodriguez. But I do like to dabble in all departments. And I have credits in most departments. And again, I'm not being arrogant and I'm not being humble when I say I'm not a master at any of them. I am, in my opinion, through lots of errors, a pretty good first AD and producer.
You know, I've actually heard quite a bit about that too. And a lot can vouch for that.
I'm not perfect. But it's something I've been working on for, 15 years.
So you've been in the industry for 15 years.
Actually, let's see. If I count 2001, when I got to Utah,
okay,
then I guess it's 20. But there's a few years there of stuff I was making that I blame myself for that I won't show anyone. Starting in 2009, I did something that was revolutionary to my career. I started trusting people more. Trust is a double-edged sword, because once you start handing things off to other people, they're either going to rise to the occasion and not disappoint you, or they're going to disappoint you and you got to do it anyway. Sometimes you got to do it over. And it sucks. But you got to keep trusting people. Case in point, I know it's a little early to get to this. Case in point, I'm doing a Kickstarter campaign right now, and I'm not doing it by myself, but it's so successful right now because so many people are rising to the occasion. And it's like I had to trust people. So that's it. We can talk about that later, but trust is my big thing I'm going off on right now. I mean, and yeah, it's hard to trust people, and you know.
Oh, yeah. You know, you get burned out when you distrust people. It sucks ass a lot of ass.
Yeah, when you're constantly trusting people, and like I said, they either rise to the occasion mm-hmm. or they don't.
Yep.
And when it constantly is happening to the don't, then you're like, what the heck here? What the heck is going on here? So anyway.
Yeah. Well, on that note then, let's have you introduce yourself real quick so we can put a voice to the face and all that good stuff.
Okay. Oh, yes. I don't know. I'm the janitor. My name is Mario DeAngelis. I am a writer, producer, director, first AD, cinematographer. But there's people way better than that than at cinematography than me. But I do it. Videographer. I've done sound. And I've been in Utah since 2001. I was born in the Midwest. I'm at heart Chicagoan. But I guess I've been in Utah for over 20 years, so I'm a Utah and Chicagoan. I'm an immigrant.
What brought you to Utah, of all places?
Oh, that's a painful subject. No, I'm just kidding. No, I moved to Utah to get married, and I got married, and I have a son. But the marriage didn't last very long. But there's a happily ever after. I have a great relationship with my ex-wife. And there's more to it, but that's the short end of the story. It just worked out. She and I were able to co-parent. I think it's a great story in this trying times of 2022 with so many weird things going on. And then I have a great son, and we got really lucky. And so I have that part of my life that was a disaster for a very short time has turned into one of the best things of my life. You know, I could have left Utah and been like, peace out.
And there you are.
So see, I was suggested that I just peace out.
Really?
But I'm glad I stuck with it.
That's
good. It meant a lot for me because you can't give up in life. And you have to, it's Galaxy Quest, you know, never give up, never surrender. Right. You just can't give up. You just got to keep going.
Right.
And eventually people will rise to the occasion. And if you do the right thing, and I know it's really hard preaching that right now, because there's so many, I'm not going to get weird, but there's a lot of bad things happening in the world. And you try and teach your son or your daughter, right? You try and teach your kids, do the right thing and you'll come out on top. Well, then there's reality. But eventually, if you stick to your guns, you could be a good person, things work out.
I believe that. I think always in the end, things work out how they're supposed to, in a way, regardless if it's to our expectations or not, but they still work out.
And it's something my mother raised me with. My mother and father raised me with this one phrase, this too shall pass. And it's true. You know, you just can't give up. So
when you moved to Utah, did you have filmmaking in the back of your mind? Like, has that always been kind of a thing for you? Or
the one thing I have in common, the one thing, I have a couple of things, but the one key thing I have in common with Steven Spielberg and Robert Rodriguez and even Quentin Tarantino is it was in my youth. I started just shooting stuff, bad stuff, like stuff I won't show anybody. And, in college, it's a little different for them. They were making movies when they were like 10 years old in the backyard. And you can see all of Spielberg's, you know, like early films, and they're all bad, but he started when he was a child. I started when I was in college. Then I went into the Navy, messed around with film and video. Video and photography. So when I started in university as a photographer, that helped my film mind. Then I took some time off, and then I ended up just moving to Utah and just doing stuff with people. And I think you're probably going to ask about film school, but I'll jump ahead and say I never went to film school. But I'm not against film school. I'm not against film classes. I'm teaching a class right now at Salt Lake Community College for, you know, film students. So, I mean, I'm not against it. It just wasn't in my path. So I learned on the job training.
Right. And I think there's a lot of benefit to that approach, too. I don't think you need it necessarily. Like, there's good stuff to both, I think so.
Right. There is. But on the flip side, I made some mistakes I shouldn't have made. And, maybe I could have made those mistakes at film school. But anyway, I made mistakes just like everybody, you know, trusting the wrong people and all this kind of stuff. So.
What kind of movies intrigued you the most? Like, who was your favorite director?
My family, my immediate family, my mother and my sisters hate this, that I am so much more into horror than they'll ever be, but horror and psychological thrillers is my answer. And then obviously, cliche as it is, you know, John Carpenter, Hitchcock, you know, they're my go-to. And the stuff they did on, like, we think it's hard to make movies right now. I mean, oh my goodness. Come on. Yeah, it's hard, but we're not shooting on film and we don't have this to worry about. We don't have that to worry about. John Carpenter made the original Halloween under 800. No, it was 300,000 or something. And they did nothing right per se. They got great stuff and it's a great movie, but they say it all the time on the behind the scenes. You know, they didn't do things right. You know, they didn't have permits. They didn't use like known actors. They didn't do any of this stuff. And George Lucas took a chance, and Steven Spielberg thought his career was over before the first screening of Jaws. He thought his career was over because he went months over budget, millions of dollars over budget on Jaws. And he thought his career was over. And it could have been. But Spielberg, Lucas, all these guys, I mean, pioneers, Scorsese, even Stallone, nobody wanted to take a chance on Rocky. You know, so I have influence. I'm influenced by all these cats.
The old school.
And I forgive John Carpenter for Escape from L.A. It's garbage, but I know people talk about it and they say that's a cult classic. Okay. Anyway,
it always makes me laugh. Like when we talk about old timers, like Ridley Scott, for example, he comes out with like movies left and right. Just last year, he came out with The Last Duel and House of Gucci, both like 2.5 hours long.
Yeah.
And it's just back to back. It's fascinating. Like the work
it is,
process.
It is fascinating. And, these cats are the top of their class, but you make one bomb and they're trying to, devalue their careers. And it pisses me off.
Yep.
Because I mean, Blade Runner 2049 is a masterpiece, but so is the first Blade Runner. And 2049 just didn't make it money. So they deemed it a failure, which just pisses everybody off because it's a masterpiece. Absolutely. 2049 is an amazing film, but so is the original.
Yep.
Anyway.
Yeah, no, I agree. I love 2049. And the fact they gave Denny.
What was that?
The fact they gave Denny, like, however budget the Dune budget was, even though 2049 was a box office failure, they still gave him more money than 2049 to make another movie that's arguably more culty than Blade Runner.
Right. it's crazy. I could talk about that stuff. I can't leave the conversation without talking about Orson Welles. But my favorite Orson Welles film, even though it is Citizen Kane, is number two for me. My favorite Orson Welles movie is a movie that gets a lot of pushback. It's Touch of Evil.
Touch of Evil is good. That gets pushback.
Touch of Evil is a masterpiece.
And that gets pushback.
The only reason why Touch of Evil is a masterpiece is there was some filmmakers 15 years ago who found the notes. It's like 50 pages of notes, editing notes. After Welles cut Touch of Evil, then he had like 50 pages of notes for himself. And he died, Orson Welles died, without remaking Touch of Evil or Director's Cut before those were a thing. And these filmmakers used his notes and recut Touch of Evil. It's crazy.
Dude. Is it better than like the original version then?
Yeah.
Wow.
But I mean, they didn't go rogue. You know, they did this with the blessing of the estate, the notes and all that. And it's amazing. Touch of Evil is great.
No, Orson Welles is great. I find myself fascinated with a lot of his works. Even like when he's just acting, you know, he's just a master class of like all
trades. Yeah, but he was master class in acting, like the Muppet movie.
Yeah,
he's in the Muppet movie. It's like one of his last roles. He's like 400. He's like 350 pounds. The poor bastard had ballooned, and he was sitting behind a desk. He did this cameo in Muppet movie, and it's just like everyone was freaking out because they got Orson Welles anyway.
Yeah. Well, that's cool. So, with that in mind, then when you started working in Utah, like how long did it take you to kind of find your groove to become the first AD that you're so known as?
That was an accident. The first AD thing came later. In 2009, I remember making a conscious decision to that my movies, because of my own deficiencies, sucked. So I decided in 2009 to start, not being in sole control of everything. So that's when that changed. And then I got a break in the first AD thing. The very first time I ever did it on a feature was a movie called Inspired Guns, directed by Adam White. And Adam just directed another movie that I think is doing well, starring John Heder. I didn't work on that one, but I worked with Adam a few years ago on Inspired Guns. And he, on the behest of the producer, said, give Mario a chance to be first AD. And it worked out. I made a lot of mistakes. But I think every day we were on time, and the movie was on time, and we got it. We made our days and all this business. So that's when that started. It was a few years later after I started like really putting more time into story, you know, and yeah. So I just spent a little more time on stuff and I got myself onto more people's sets. And that's where a lot of things changed, where I started learning from other people. And the number one thing I always try to remember to say is that no set is different. And I get pushback on that. But no set is the same. Like you go on one set, a Christmas movie for Hallmark, it's going to be run differently than Yellowstone.
Oh, for sure.
Which is going to be run differently from an indie film.
Oh, yeah.
Which is going to be run differently from a music video. And that's it. I think people try to argue with me, but I don't think it's something you can argue. It's just every project's different. It has its own flavor. It has its own rules. There are set things, you know. I mean, people listening to this, I get it. It has set things that need to happen. Yeah, sure, I get that. But, you know, there's just sometimes there are certain jobs that aren't on set because it's just not needed.
No, exactly. Especially like, you know, the more like John Carpenter run of the mill kind of stuff. I know they had actors, like a lot of the actors who died from Michael Myers, right? Were actually, they stayed on set to help out with lighting and whatever else.
Okay.
And that to me sounds fun filmmaking. Like it just sounds, you know, let's see if it works, experiment, you know, story of your life, like more stories to tell, but, in Yellowstone or something that has a bigger budget, I, you know, you could just assume it's going to be ran a lot different, probably more corporate than
it's more corporate. There's the way I see it is when you add people or money or both, it gets more complicated.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm saying it's a fact. You add 200 person crew is a little harder to manage. And the first AD, it's all on his or her shoulders. And, that's really different. 200 a crew, 300 crew is different than 20. It's a fact. You know, $7 million episodes, and you have to crank it out in 9 days. It's more stressful. It's a fact.
Oh, man.
It's not about, it's less about skill, and it's more about attitude, temperament, experience. Could I handle one day on Yellowstone, or would I get fired? I'm not going to say either way. I don't know. Because I ended up on a movie once as a fill-in first AD, because I already had one, but she had to go do something. Or she got COVID or something. And I stepped in. I only was there for 6 hours. But that had nothing to do with me, because they had to shut the set down at lunch because too many people were popping positive for COVID. That had nothing to do with me.
Yeah.
But you know, that was success. I mean, that was an unsuccessful day for me, you know. But you know, I mean, nobody was blaming me, but you know, COVID, you know, has affected things drastically.
Do the dang first AD caused all that COVID outbreak.
What?
So the first AD caused all the COVID on set. That's how they would blame you if you didn't make it. No, that's it's interesting. I agree though. I mean, each set's differently, and I think they could be just said for any project. I mean, just like even just from like a writing, because I'm a writer myself, right? Like,
right.
I kind of approach each one differently with a different mindset. And even right. when I'm writing it, I could see it being shot differently and ran differently. And like, who would be on, you know what I mean? Like, it's just, it's going to be different. And I think that's something you have to face, but
it is. And, it's nuts though. I've got stories. So we've got our own history. Not it's good history.
My first memory of you, because you know we were working on a set for on a film project, but
yeah.
I was a stand-in PA, I guess, if you will, and it was like my first time out on a film set after graduation of high school. So like it was like, you know, me wanting to like actually get onto like a set, and my cousin was like, you know, the creature of this movie, and he that's how I got on. But I remember they needed somebody to run sound, and I had no idea what I was doing with sound, and you were trying to give me pointers on how to hold the boom mic, and I'm like, this is like hard ass work. Like, what? And so I just remember you just trying to teach me the ropes, you know, on how to do stuff on set. So I think that's a good first memory.
Oh, that's good. And I'm glad you told that story. And that particular project, that was a rough one for us. And I recall that. Yeah, I'm trying to help you. Yeah, and hopefully I wasn't a jerk about it. I guess I wasn't. Every once in a while, I run into people who I've worked with now for years, and they tell me their first impressions. And I've gotten some doozies, man. I don't even know if I should tell them. They're embarrassing because, one, I either don't remember it because I was doing the first AD thing. I feel so bad when someone says, oh, yeah, the first time I watched you do your thing, you were yelling at somebody. I was like, wait a second. I'm not trying to invalidate your story. I'm saying, was I yelling in general or was I yelling at somebody? Oh, no, you were just being loud. Okay, that's a little different. And then I have people who are like, oh, I didn't know how you were. I wasn't sure how to take you. And then I got to know you. Things like that. And I had to get over those kind of comments because those things are going to happen. You know, you catch one little snapshot of anybody. It doesn't matter if they're the first AD or the second AD or the director. You get with somebody on a snapshot and you think that that's how they are. That's not necessarily fair, but I understand. I understand why people think those kind of things sometimes, like, oh, you were in a bad mood that day. Was I in a bad mood or was I just trying to keep things rolling?
Yeah.
It's a hard job to decipher because you never know really what the person, sometimes I've seen some great ADs. They're never off kilter. They're just on and they're always fine, but nobody's perfect. So I see a first AD and I'm like, oh, he's fantastic. And then the next day he could have a bad day. But the day I was there for 12 hours, he was spot on. But the next day, maybe something's wrong at home. Maybe something's going on and they can't leave. You know, things happen. We got to remember that there was more to the story. Constant. And I forget that sometimes. And I'm like, oh, wait a minute. I don't know the whole story. So just remember when you're on a set and you see somebody, it doesn't matter what job they're doing.
Remember. Especially because film sets have so much complications that arise. Like 2 minutes before you even start recording, something can happen and not everybody's privy to the information, right? And so it's like certain people are just like, oh, fuck, here we go. You know, like it's going to be one of those days. Right.
Look, the bottom line is I would never go on record as to say making a movie is the hardest job on the planet. It's not. It's not. However, there are more complexities. And I will share a story I'll never forget. One of my first features I ever did in Utah. This guy who doesn't even make movies anymore, he went to medical school for 8 years, became a surgeon, said, I'm good. I've been a surgeon for a few years. I'm good. I'm going to go make movies. So he got some financing together, won an award for a short film called The First Vampire, got some momentum, said, okay, cool. I think I'm ready for a feature. And all I was doing was capturing the behind the scenes. And I put it into a 60-minute behind the scene documentary. It's not great. And that's my fault, but it's not great. But I do have those memories now because I captured all of these things that happened. And the one soundbite that I got that I'll never forget is this director. The movie ended up being called Unrest. And they got picked up on this thing that doesn't exist anymore, but it's called The 8 Films to Die For. So Unrest got bought from this first thing of 8 Films to Die For. They got horror movies. And they were going to run them all together. They ran them all together for a few years. They did this like thing. So they scooped up a bunch of horror movies, put them in theaters, said, watch all these 8 movies. Anyway, Unrest was one of them. So the director, Jason, I've got him on tape saying, there was something not going well. And he looks at the camera and he says, being a surgeon is easier. So I got the surgeon director at the beginning of my career in Utah telling me just like, he's just like so frustrated because things are taking forever just to do a blood gag in a shower. And he was just like, he looked right at the camera. It's an amazing soundbite. Doing surgery is easier. And I believe them.
That's funny.
It's crazy. But again, not the hardest job ever, but it's harder than people think.
Right. And I think that's where a lot of like the roles come into, you know, like the roles are there to help kind of ease the transition, but you have to have a lot of pre-planning and you have to have everybody on the same page. And when one of those elements or both are missing, then it's going to be a clusterfuck of a shoot that everybody's going to remember as being an awful experience. Even if the end product's good, it's not going to be a good experience in the process, you know?
No, that's absolutely right. And that brings up, that's a great point. That brings up pre-production. And I mean, it doesn't save everything all the time, but oh my goodness. Just doing floor plans of where your lights are going.
Yeah.
I mean, it took me years and I still sometimes can't do those, but I mean, you should always do stuff like that. And it can be hand drawn. There's things you can do. You don't need technology. Technology is great. And I don't love Studio Binder, but it's a nice tool. But you can do things without being all technical. Just get some paper or get some highlighters and do your breakdown. You don't have to make excuses like, oh, I couldn't find the breakdown I wanted, so I never did one. Well, you know, get some highlighters and, you know, pick a color. Pink is for props. I don't know. Do something. Solve the problems. Yeah. Do your breakdowns. Do your shot list. Storyboards, if possible. Great filmmaker I work with, Lenny Wito.
Yeah, I know Lenny's great.
And he uses storyboards as a shot list. So he takes the shot and does a little hand-drawn thing. It's nothing crazy. And that's his storyboard. That's his shot list.
Man, I love it.
That's just why he just wrapped a feature doing it that way.
That's so cool.
So I mean, it's just like, do the tools that work for you, but just, you know, find a way to do them.
Yeah, no, Lenny's talented. That's cool that he does it that way. I'm always intrigued how directors are, because, like, you know, each director is a little bit different, like how they.
And there might be times when he doesn't do the pictures, but I think for the most part, he tries to do the little pictures, and that's his shot list. And like I said, it works for him, nobody has anything else to, you know, say about it, right?
Right. So with pre-production, then, because like, as you stated, you have a Kickstarter going on now for a new project. Yes. Is that in pre-production now? Or are you still waiting on stuff? Or do you want to talk about that for a minute?
Actually, that's a great question. I was about to say, no, we're waiting, but pre-production has started. So you're absolutely right. So a breakdown by my friend Joe Puente has been done. Joe did a breakdown. We have the preliminary budget based on the amount we think we're going to raise on the Kickstarter campaign, which is happening right now through March 24th. And Evan was nice enough to have me on the show today. So yeah, you have till March 24th if you want to donate. There's perks just like every Kickstarter. We're trying for 29.5, so 29,500. But you're right. Pre-production has begun, because if we get funded on March 24th, or we do stretch goals, or however it'll work out, hopefully we get a little more stretch goals. We got to go straight into serious pre-pro, because I do want to be shooting April 1st through the 4th is my plan. And it's a little hard to explain, but this particular script, we're doing it in two halves. I know everyone who's watching is going to be like, wait a minute, you're supposed to shoot movies in a row. Well, that's true. And I wanted to, but I'm not going to get into details. Somebody else scheduled something, so I wasn't able to go straight through. And I'm teaching a class at Salt Lake Community. So instead of waiting 2 months, we're going to go for it.
Dude, and that's so excited.
I have people who just go for it and it does work out. Quick story. I was working with my campaign managers on their first movie called Twice the Dream. This was a couple of, this was years ago. They worked on their first movie, Twice the Dream. It took 10 years to make that one. But Twice the Dream, Savannah Osler Diallo and her husband, Steve Diallo, came to me and said, Mario, we want you to be first AD and whatever else you want, but we need you to help us with this movie. I was like, okay. Okay. What's your shooting schedule? Oh, we're going to shoot it all on weekends. And I said, whoa, 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 whoa. What? And they talked me through it. And I said, okay, I'm going to trust you. It's your movie. I'll do it. But weekends, 7 weekends, sure as shit, it worked. I don't know what else to say other than I was wrong. But for the most part, yes. 5 days in a row, 2 days off. 5 days in a row, 2 days off. 6 days in a row, maybe. I work with Rob Diamond. He does 6 days. But his days are usually 10 hours or something like that. So it's okay. It's legal. But Rob Diamond kind of goes 6 days sometimes. But sometimes he goes five. Love working with Rob, too. Different types of filmmaking. You know, the rules are different. And that's okay. But I did not think 7 weekends was going to work. I officially was wrong.
Yeah, here you are.
And then we did a hybrid for their second movie called Even in Dreams. That was a hybrid because we had an A-list actor or a B-list. I can't remember what list she's on. Her name, she is from Little House on the Prairie. And she came in for 5 days. So we did go five in a row, and then we did 3 weekends. So we did a hybrid.
So you adapted to the schedule.
The talent, yeah.
That's fair.
Allison was on like number two. Monica Moore Smith was number one, and Allison Arngrim was number two or whatever she was.
Right.
But yeah, that was a different thing, and that was SAG, so we had to follow those rules. And it was in the middle of COVID, so we had to follow those rules. So yeah, COVID has changed the game. Well, I mean, we're at the tail end, I guess, but whatever. It changed the rules for about 2 years.
So working,
and people were still working, but it was hard.
Yes. So working on as many projects as you have, what's some of the key differences between like working SAG and not working SAG?
Okay. Well, that brings me to my current project, to which we're doing the Kickstarter, Limbo. Limbo is not going to be a SAG project. The differences are SAG is a wonderful organization. I will not speak ill of SAG on camera. SAG is an organization that is very good for actors. I will leave it there. But dealing with SAG, they have lots of rules. My point is, from my movie Limbo, which I have contemplated going SAG, you need more money. They take a down payment. There's like 50 other reasons why going SAG is a little more expensive. So sometimes pictures just can't go SAG because it costs money to start up the process. They take a down payment because they want to make sure their actors get paid. So not to go into too many details, but you have to follow those rules. And then a SAG rep has to come on. They can come on whenever they want, just pop in. So it's very different. Non-SAG projects are extremely different from SAG projects. And some people get used to the SAG stuff, and they have other producers who can deal with SAG and know all the rules. Another thing about SAG, which I will go on camera saying, is they don't always tell you how the rules have changed. So you think you're playing basketball, and like everything's cool, man. Everyone's playing basketball. And then the next day, SAG could change their rules, which is a fact. They change their rules and their parameters. And all of a sudden, you're playing soccer. Or you're doing a luge. You know, all the rules of the game change. And they forgot to tell you that you need a payroll company to do your payroll. Okay.
And then you gotta follow the rules.
And if you don't follow the rules, you get, everyone say it with me, penalized.
Fine, yeah.
So all that, I didn't say anything that isn't true. Everything about what I said is true. But SAG is fine and all, and they're there for the actors. That's all I'm going to say.
And we like that. We like that they are taking care of the actors.
And they really do. And I've seen it in action. And a friend of mine was on the receiving end of, we don't necessarily think it was a legitimate claim, but he made a claim against a friend of mine, executive producer friend of mine, and it took months to solve it. It's just like so time consuming. So, but if you got a chance, the problem with not going SAG is you got a chance to bring on an actor and they won't do the picture because it is not SAG. Utah's different. We have different rules, work, but right to work. A SAG actor can choose to do a non-SAG picture. That's a fact. But there's consequences to that, maybe for the actors. So they have to weigh those situations. So some actors we asked to be in movies that we've worked on, that I've produced. Excuse me. They won't do the movie because it's not SAG.
Right.
Understandable. So you might lose somebody who might bring more money to the project. So would I ever go SAG? Of course I will. Eventually. Limbo, we're only going for $29.5, and right now that's all we can afford. And that's the bargain basement we can make the movie for. And right now, Limbo is not SAG. But before I forget, an hour ago, we got to 47% funded. So it's going really well.
Dude, that's a fuck yeah.
It is.
Any money, dude, like it's just like a, oh yeah, that feels good. Does it feel good? I think that would feel good. I haven't done a Kickstarter, but I imagine it feels good.
It does feel good. And then I was told something that doesn't feel good is Marshall Moore told me yesterday that we were asking for more money through the state legislature to bring in bigger projects to Utah. Apparently that got shot down. So SB whatever apparently is dead, which there's like one thing he told me that we still might have a chance at, but I'm not going to go into the politics, but it sucks.
Yes, it does.
So what he said to me was, yeah, keep up doing the keep going with the Kickstarters because where's the money coming from? I mean, everyone's got to work. And so many people are being so generous with our campaign. I can't even believe it. I shouldn't maybe jinx it, but I got some wood in front of me. So I'm knocking on wood. We have so many generous people and so many family members, and it's turning into a family affair. And that's how I see it anyway. So we have so many family members of the actors, of the crew members, so many people like going above and beyond. My three leads, Eric Osmond, John Terry, and Kendra Burris, they have just gone above and beyond to help us out. And they didn't need to really do that. They could have been like, oh, peace out. Let me know when the movie's coming.
Yeah.
Or let me know if we're shooting. No, but they really care about it. And they care about the script. They believe in what I'm doing. And one of my siblings have been amazing. My mom, my mother. I mean, they've all, you know, come forward. And one of my sisters said, you've been doing this for so long, something's got to break. Is Limbo going to be the break? Maybe. You just got to keep going.
So how did Limbo come to be?
Good question. So I went to Blake Castleman, who wrote the screenplay. It's been sitting around, and it's another reason why I had to put a fire under my keister, was this movie was sitting around collecting dust. And that also doesn't feel good when you've worked so hard on a script. You're up to about 10 drafts, which is fairly normal, and you're doing nothing with it. So Blake Castleman kindly asked me to get it moving, and I said, okay. So we got it moving. I asked him to write me a script for two locations. That's bottom line. That's what it was. And he came up, and then I said, you know, basically parameters. He came up with the whole plot line and the character names, and it's his script. But I just wanted something for two locations, and he did that. Then he gave me this great script. What happened was I took him to this place where we were going to shoot. It was an old church in Rose Park. We're not going to shoot there anymore. But we walked around, and he was creating the story as we were walking around, you see. That's how it happened. And then we filled in the gaps and we did the drafts and took characters out. There was a few too many characters at one point. Now it's evolved into, he's been writing the novelization of the screenplay. He's been writing a book about this script. And eventually the book will get done. And we're hoping to, you know, whoever did a certain perk, they'll get a copy of the book. Digital at first, and then if they got to a different level, they may get a paperback. They will get a paperback of the book once it's done. So the book's not done. The screenplay's ready to go, obviously. So we're going to have to kick into high gear if we get funded on March 24th so we can be ready. And the 4 days I'm least concerned about are April 1st to the 4th. So that's going to be a lot of opportunity for background, too. Extras who want to be in it. And some of the perks involve, you know, you pay a certain amount and you can be a background extra. You can be an extra for the day or come on and have lunch with the crew and that kind of stuff. So those perks. And another thing we did with our perks were sometimes with these Kickstarter campaigns, associate producer starts at 1,000. I dropped it to 500 and the executive producer starts at 1,000. Where usually it starts at like 1,500 or 2,000. And that's not a slight on other campaigns. I just wanted to do it a little lower. And we have a lot, we have a lot of people who took the associate producer level.
So what's
and then we have a lot of executive producers too. Go ahead.
So what's the difference between a like associate and executive then? Like is there different roles that they play?
Well, how shall I say this? The first person, I'm sure no one will ever know. The first person who decided to start doing this on a crowdsourcing campaign was probably back in the day when Indiegogo was more popular than the Kickstarter, which is a fact. Indiegogo started this whole crowdsourcing thing. I remember when they first started and nobody else was doing it. Indiegogo it's still around, but Kickstarter became a little more famous. Whoever started doing this on whatever platform, somebody came up with, you can pay to become an associate producer or executive producer. What do they do? They put in their money.
Yeah.
I don't know what else to say. They don't get jobs. It's not a job. They don't have to do anything.
I wonder.
It's a title. It's a title. Now, the actual executive producers in the movie will be in a different block in the credits.
Right.
Like, it'll say executive producer Kickstarter campaign. Or associate producer Kickstarter campaign. And then the other people who have been working for months will be in this different category, but it'll also say executive producers.
Right.
I mean, that's the respectful way to like break it up.
No, I get that.
Yeah, but everybody knows what's going on. I mean, it's not bad.
No, yeah. So with projects though, I mean, there is the famous, you know, what's the elevator pitch? Well, Mario.
Okay. Hold on. I want to check the time. Okay, because I gotta go to work soon.
Yes,
because yes. I have to pay for this movie. I'm just kidding. Okay, a newlywed couple are about to embark on their honeymoon when they are abducted by strangers. That's the log line. The elevator pitch is a little longer because that's like 60 seconds or whatever it is. I don't know the average elevator length. But I've got the answer for like what we go into. But essentially the movie is about if I forget to say this, my campaign manager will be mad at me. www.thelimbomovie.com will take you to the Kickstarter page and you'll see a 3 minute, 15 second video explaining it. But essentially it's a movie about choice, consequence. I wrote this and I can't even remember it. Choice, consequence, love, loss, choice, and consequence. That's like the subhead under Limbo. Love, loss, choice, and consequence. Because so everything we do has a consequence. And sometimes somebody abducts you from a limousine on your way to your honeymoon and you get tied up and you have to face your ghosts and your demons. I don't know.
Yeah, that'd be terrifying.
What's that?
So that'd be terrifying.
Well,
that's one honeymoon not to be ever forgotten, you know?
Yeah. Well, speaking of that, I my nobody really knows this. So this is like, I guess, hot off the press. I doubt I will do this, but I'm thinking for this particular story, two versions may be appropriate. So I am fairly certain I'm going to do like what would be called considered a PG-13 version. And then I'm probably going to do a little darker version. And I have some ideas I'm going to throw through past the director. I think I have a way to take it up a notch. The only way we can take it up a notch is if we get stretch goals and get more money. But that goes back to the SAG question. Like, if we somehow doubled our budget from the campaign, which may or may not happen, we just want to get it funded just the normal amount we asked for. But if something happens and we get more money, well, then we could afford to go SAG. I mean, so many things could happen. But again, I'm so appreciative of all the backers. We have 74. That's ridiculous. In 8 days?
That's cool. I think Kickstarters and crowdfunding, like, if you will, there's a unique approach to it and a lot of hard work that goes into it.
Sure.
And a lot of, like, there's like some YouTubers I follow who won't even approach it at all because, you know, it's just hard. It's so much dedication. But I've had so many friends, you know, attempt to launch a Kickstarter or an Indiegogo, and quite a few have actually been successful. And so it kind of gives me like this like hope of some sense of like, oh, yeah, this could be the indie route to go, you know?
You know, even in Dreams of Movie, I spoke about Savannah Osler Diallo. She's my campaign manager, and she taught me the stuff that she was taught, because they did their own campaign, even in Dreams, which not only made its money, well, not only made its money during the campaign, that they got two stretch goals, but they told me, she came up with this statement, and I think it's true, or she learned it from somewhere, but I think it's true. Running a crowdsourcing campaign, and people who I know who have done it successfully, it's like it's its own movie. We have a crew. We have people. It's called a core team, and they've been doing an amazing job. You're right. It's like its own job. And it is. It's like its own little production. And you do. You have to be on it every, like, all the time. And I knew that. And but then I've had people who, I've been on it every day, and I've had to focus on it every day. But I have so many people who are helping me that I'm not going to lose my mind, hopefully.
Knock on wood.
But like I said, I can't say this enough. Being almost 50% funded, it warms my heart. So we're not done, but we're pretty positive about it.
That's cool, man. I'm gonna root for you guys. That's
root
fucking,
for us.
Fucking excellent. Where can people find more information about that and about you?
Oh, okay. So www.thelimbomovie.com takes you to the Kickstarter campaign. Okay. We're on Facebook. We got a bunch of people on Instagram and all those other formats putting out the word. And all you have to do is put in that www. That gets you access. And then Facebook, of course. On Facebook, it's called The Limbo Movie, but it doesn't quite matter. Just put in Limbo. You'll find it. So our Facebook page is awesome. Lots of traffic. I'm excited about this, but no one seems to really be excited about it. There's a lot of like engagements and shares and likes, and we're in the thousands in that, you know, percentages off the road, off the charts for me. But some people are like, it's all right.
I'd be excited, you know, like
I'm excited. I know.
Boom.
I want people to get excited about it. In regards to me, I mean, I have all the normal stuff. I mean, I don't have a website. I know they're not dying, but, you know, I don't have a website. And my stuff's all over YouTube. My thing that I push is, you know, go check out my IMDb. That's easy because it's just my name, Mario DeAngelis. But right now I'm all about promoting this campaign, and, you know, that's cool. And then my Facebook page gets some traffic. I mean, I don't know the numbers, my own personal.
Yeah.
And I don't know. But, you know, people seem to care when I post stuff. Oh, they really care. I'm not political on Facebook anymore, but I did it like twice and I paid the price. So I don't do it no more. It's just, there's no point.
No, that's why I had to create another Facebook profile because I probably ruined my engagement on my personal.
It might. And it's just ridiculous. Well, we won't get into that, but yeah, I just think it's ridiculous. If your life is destroyed because our friendships and family relationships are destroyed because of some stupid post on Facebook, in 10 years won't matter.
Yeah. Yeah.
But tweets matter because James Gunn got fired for 15-year-old tweets that he made, and Disney fired him. So he went to DC and made the best Suicide Squad movie ever. Anyway.
Okay. On that note, then, I like to end this just on two questions, and then I can let you go real quick. How do you hope that you can inspire others is my first question.
Oh, that's a good question. Just remember that your experience in one situation does not always equate to the next. So be open to change. And don't give up. One thing I learned from Savannah and Steve, they made these two movies, Twice a Dream and Even in Dreams. They had plenty of opportunity to give up. And then they found people like me that were going to support them, and they have family and friends who supported them through these two movies. So don't let anyone tell you you can't.
I love it. That's a good, that actually answered all the questions.
Yay.
Knocked it out.
With, that's it? There's no more questions?
No, man. I mean, no, I think we covered stuff. I know you got to get going soon, so I just don't want to.
Yeah, but I mean, that campaign is the most important thing right now. Yeah. And like I said, so many people care about it, and they don't even know what the script looks like, you know? But they're only trusting us that it's not, you know, it's not anything too weird.
Well,
that's most people will know me. It's going to be a little weird.
Well, that's the trust, though. I mean, you know, you set out these perks and you say, trust me as a filmmaker to give you these perks, right? And to give you a film that you are a part of officially. Right. So,
I mean, you're absolutely right. That's a really good point. Yeah.
I think it's cool. I'm rooting for you guys. Check out Limbo, the website, and you can follow the podcast and stuff too. But Mario, it was nice catching up finally after all these years, man, of not catching up. Just staying on the loop on Facebook, but
yeah, absolutely.
I'm sure we'll run into each other and work on.
All right, thanks projects. Again for doing this. Yeah, keep it up. I should be doing my own, but you know, you're staying dedicated to it, and that's what you need to do. Is stay dedicated to whatever your passion is.
Exactly. Yeah, that's
keep it up, man.
Thanks, man. We'll stay in touch.
All right.